Hi, this is Alex Kantrowitz. I'm the host of Big Technology Podcast, a longtime reporter and an on-air contributor to CNBC. And if you're like me, you're trying to figure out how artificial intelligence is changing the business world and our lives. So each week on Big Technology, I bring on key actors from companies building AI tech and outsiders trying to influence it, asking where this is all going. They come from places like NVIDIA, Microsoft, Amazon, and plenty more. So if you want to be smart with your wallet, your career choices, in meetings with your colleagues, and at dinner parties, listen to Big Technology Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
The Chinese government says it's committed to cutting greenhouse gas emissions.
China's newly announced climate goals are modest, but they reflect current realities.
Why Beijing is going public with a new climate pledge. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. The new government in Syria steps onto the global stage after a long absence.
We're here. We're back. We're excited to catch up with what we missed for the last 6 decades.
Also today, a policy of forced contraception in Greenland had dire consequences on the impact of women and girls.
You will hear them recount pain, infertility, and lifelong trauma.
And a potential breakthrough in preventing HIV.
What you have here is science meeting political will, meeting community activism.
All that and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. For well over half a century, Syria under the Assad family had been viewed with suspicion and then isolated on the international stage. It was largely seen as a pariah state. But on Wednesday, Syria's interim president, Ahmad al-Shara, made history when he spoke at the podium of the United Nations General Assembly in New York. Al-Shara said, the Syrian story is about the struggle between good and evil. We've suffered injustice, deprivation, and oppression. Then we rose up to claim our dignity. He spoke about the challenges Syria currently faces after years of civil war and harsh economic sanctions.
Al-Shara also met with President Trump and the First Lady, as well as Secretary of State Marco Rubio. But while the international community embraces Syria's interim president, some Syrians have questions about where he's taking their country. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
Ahmad al-Shara is a man who, until last December, was leading a rebel group in Syria that was fighting the Syrian government. The U.S. put a $10 million bounty on his head. Fast forward 9 months, and now everyone wants to meet with Shara. He had a packed schedule this week in New York, meeting with high-level officials and participating in side events. He met with Syrian Americans, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, and Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni. But none of these meetings were as surprising as the one on Monday. Shara sat face-to-face with a former adversary, General David Petraeus, retired U.S. Army general who used to lead the CIA. Petraeus heaped praise on Shara.
His trajectory from insurgent leader to head of state has been one of the most dramatic political transformations in recent Middle Eastern history.
Petraeus and Shara were enemies during the U.S.'s wars in the Middle East. Shara was even arrested by American forces and spent 5 years in detention. Petraeus began his conversation with him by getting that awkward history out of the way.
We were on different sides when I was commanding the surge in Iraq. And here you are now as the president of Syria.
It's good that at one time we were in combat, and now we are in dialogue, Shara responded. The two men seemed cordial, with Petraeus dropping in Arabic here and there. The Syrian leader seems to have won the hearts of American and European officials after roughly 9 months in power. In his speech at the United Nations, he said a new Syria is taking shape. He talked about the fact-finding missions his government has set up to bring to justice those accountable for past crimes. But Shara is also facing criticism at home. Under his leadership, the country has seen episodes of sectarian violence. In one instance, last spring, about 1,500 people belonging to the Alawite minority group were killed, according to reports. More violence broke out recently in the south of the country.
Unfortunately, I am concerned.
Mohammed Al-Abdullah heads the Syrian Justice and Accountability Center in Washington.
as a former prisoner during Assad time, as a human rights defender for the last 22 years, I don't see that type of behavior that supports the remarks and the promises the president is making.
Abdullah says he's concerned about how the new president has consolidated power for himself.
He is the president, he's the chief of the command, he is the head of the National Security Council, he's the chief of the Supreme Judiciary Council, he appoints the Supreme Court justices, he is the prime minister. And okay, if you keep going, the list is quite long, honestly, and this scares somebody like me.
The civil war may have ended, but Syria remains divided, he says. Groups running different parts are not willing to relinquish power to a central one in Damascus. Abdullah says bringing them all together doesn't seem to be a priority for Sharia. It doesn't help, he adds, that he surrounded himself by adoring supporters.
We want to treat him as a human. He makes mistakes and he should be held accountable. Otherwise, we are honestly risking our revolution and we're just creating a new version of Bashar al-Assad.
I put Abdullah's comments to Qutayba Idlibi. We spoke in the garden outside of the United Nations building. Idlibi is the Director of American Affairs at Syria's Foreign Ministry, helping to shape Sharia's foreign policy.
Look, this government has inherited a lot of actual landmines in Syria, military landmines, but also inherited a lot of political, social, and economic landmines as well. What this government has been focused on is really how to mend those fracture lines between different communities.
Idlibi says the government is fully aware of the sectarian tensions. His message to the families of those who lost loved ones in recent clashes:
our message to them is that there will be accountability, that everyone who has committed a crime or a violation will be held accountable, and that, you know, their pain is not, you know, lost on us as a government.
Besides the domestic challenges, the new government in Syria faces pressure from its neighbor, Israel, as well. Israeli forces have continuously bombarded parts of Syria since the new government took power. They have also taken control of parts of the south. The two sides are working on a security agreement, and Idlibi says that stability will be beneficial for all.
We don't want Syria to be a ground for any threat towards anyone in the region, especially Israel. But at the same time, we expect other countries as well, including Israel, not to constitute a threat against Syria, against Syria's sovereignty and unity.
Are they listening?
I believe that they have started to listen recently. I think there was an issue of understanding each other and like getting to know each other.
Idlibi tells me right now there is a security framework under discussion. He hopes they will finalize and agree on it before the end of the UN meetings. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari at the United Nations.
Another leader from the Middle East who addressed the UN General Assembly today was the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. He spoke on a video link because the Trump administration refused to give Palestinian officials visas to travel to New York.
Abbas thanked the countries that recently recognized the state of Palestine and said that the leadership he represents recognized Israel many years ago. Abbas also declared that Hamas will have no role in governing Gaza after the war there ends.
Hamas and other factions will have to hand over their weapons as part of a process to build the institutions of a one state, one law, and one legal security forces.
Abbas said that Israel has been carrying out a war of genocide, destruction, starvation, and displacement in Gaza. Tomorrow, Friday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will deliver his own speech at UN headquarters in person. He's expected to denounce the Western governments that just recognized Palestinian statehood. We will have that story for you tomorrow.
Turning now to some hopeful news in the area of global health, the world's Bianca Hillier brings us up to speed on a drug that's expected to make a big difference in the HIV epidemic.
When it comes to HIV prevention drugs, a once-daily pill known as PrEP has been the global standard for years. It works, and the generic versions are pretty affordable. But now there's another option.
A medicine called lenacapavir, which is a revolutionary prevention tool for HIV, the HIV virus.
Carmen Perez-Casas is the HIV Senior Strategy Lead at UnitedAid, a global organization that works to make life-saving drugs affordable. She's among the many experts saying lenacapavir is one of the biggest scientific breakthroughs in decades. It's made by Gilead Sciences, a U.S. biopharmaceutical company.
A little over a year ago, we first learned that lenacapavir, this antiretroviral, was remarkable prevention.
Mitchell Warren is the executive director of AVAC, an HIV prevention organization.
In two different clinical trials, in different populations around the world, it was shown to be near perfect in prevention.
Near perfect. But there's even more good news up lenacapavir's sleeve. Perez-Casas again.
It's not very easy to see in science a product that is at the same time highly efficient and also easier to use than other alternatives.
Lenacapavir is easier to use because it only has to be taken twice a year by injection. That's compared to oral PrEP's daily mandate, which creates a number of barriers.
People have busy lives. You forget to take pills. That can be a challenge.
Saika Mullick is the director of implementation science at VITS-RHI, a research institute in South Africa. The thing is, it's not cheap. A few months ago, in June, when lenacapavir was approved by the FDA in the U.S., maker Gilead said the drug would have a list price of $28,000 a year. Advocates worried that a market for generic versions of the drug would take years and years. But this week, a major announcement. Starting in 2027, lenacapavir will be available for about $40 per person per year in low- and middle-income countries.
This is a pretty big deal. What you have here is science meeting political will, meaning community activism.
Gerard Radovosian is a senior fellow at the Duke Global Health Institute.
When all the stars align in that way, you have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to really make a difference in the trajectory of the global HIV response. And that's what's in front of us right now.
The deal was announced yesterday, and it was brokered by UnitedAid, the Clinton Health Access Initiative, and VITS-RHI. They negotiated a partnership with Dr. Reddy's Laboratories, a generics manufacturer in India. At the same time, the Gates Foundation announced a similar deal with Hetero, which is the world's largest HIV drug manufacturer and is also based in India. AVAC's Mitchell Warren says this price reduction is a really important moment.
Translating remarkable science into public health impact is a journey, and it often takes many years. And what was announced this week really jump starts the process in a way that has typically taken years to deliver product at scale.
Gerard Radovosian again.
If we can get 30 to 40 million people on an injectable PrEP over the next 3 to 5 years, that is a major milestone that we'll look back at 2030 and see that new infection curve maybe cut in half. And that will actually get us closer to one day imagining a world without HIV.
Mitchell Warren cautions that there is no magical or miracle drug, perhaps especially when it comes to HIV.
The reality in HIV is that it's not the products that can prevent and treat alone. There's a huge amount of stigma. And we've seen that for 44 years of this epidemic, and there is no pill or injection to prevent stigma.
In other words, that stigma keeps some people from ever getting treatment. On top of that is what he calls the Herculean task of logistics to get lenacapavir to the people who need it. Saika Mullick in South Africa, the country with the highest number of HIV cases, says that work is underway.
We now have the challenge of getting the policies in place, adding lenacapavir to essential medicine lists so that they can be procured by government, adapting services to include lenacapavir, and also innovating with service delivery models.
Warren points out that this would be hard at any time, but it's especially challenging now.
In global health, the programs best placed to deliver this product are the programs that have been gutted over the last 8 months.
The Trump administration has halted the U.S. government's foreign aid program, USAID, with a particular impact on the fight against HIV and AIDS.
So it is one of the cruelest ironies that we have this incredible scientific advance, but it's coming at the moment that is going to be the hardest to overcome many of these programmatic obstacles.
A cruel irony, and still a moment to celebrate, says Gerard Radovosian from Duke.
This is a moment of progress, as a moment of opportunity that's going to bring hope to millions of people, millions of families, millions of children, millions of pregnant women. You know, so this moment of hope is worth celebrating.
Now, he says, it's up to public health infrastructure to implement it successfully. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The Chinese government is setting new climate goals for itself. They include boosting the production of renewable energy sources and cutting back on greenhouse gas emissions. That is just ahead. You're listening to The World.
Hi, I'm Mike Troy, host of the American Revolution podcast on the Airwave Media Network. This podcast is the origin story of the United States, how we went from colonies ruled by a king to the democratic republic that we have today. The American Revolution podcast tells the story of the revolution from beginning to end. Please subscribe for free. We're available on all major podcast platforms. I hope you will join me today on the American Revolution podcast.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Thanks to its explosive economic growth, China is now the biggest emitter of carbon dioxide on Earth. That's why an announcement from Chinese leader Xi Jinping is getting a lot of attention. In a video broadcast at the United Nations General Assembly yesterday, Xi said that China plans to cut carbon dioxide and other planet-warming pollutants by 7 to 10% over the next decade. He said China would also expand its non-fossil fuel energy sources by 30%.
This is the first time that the Chinese government is announcing these kinds of climate targets. Joanna Lewis is a professor at Georgetown and an expert on China's climate policy.
While China has always essentially indexed its targets to economic growth, meaning that, you know, total emissions could keep going up as long as the economy went up as well, this is a real shift, and this will actually require emissions to decline and across all greenhouse gases.
I want to kind of figure out what is happening within China. It is already a juggernaut in the clean energy sector. How did they make that happen? I am assuming that there was a lot of policy that went into this.
That's right. I mean, I think China was one of the first countries to really realize that they could become a leader in clean energy technologies and that this would create a massive opportunity for their economy. So it would certainly help with climate goals. But I think for China, it's really much more than that. It's a way to grow their economy and create jobs. And so China did this through decades of really strategic, you know, what we call industrial policy to build these new clean energy industries, coupled with broader energy and climate policy goals.
So is it fair to say that this was done for economic reasons and the climate benefits would be what? A nice side benefit?
I think the Chinese government sees multiple benefits. There's air pollution benefits, which are valuable for public health. There's climate benefits, certainly in terms of emissions reductions. There's innovation benefits. China has really become the world leader in innovating many of the next generation clean energy technologies the world will need. So it was strategic.
In his video speech for the UN, Xi called the energy transition the, quote, trend of our time. What did he mean by that?
Well, we are already in a world where clean energy is surpassing fossil energy in terms of new build. China, while it still gets more of its energy from coal, for example, than it does from wind and solar, actually has more, you know, wind turbines and solar panels installed for the first time ever this year than coal plants. So this is a real shift. You know, we're seeing countries move towards these cleaner sources of energy. And again, climate change is certainly one motivator, but also these technologies are cost competitive, which has really resulted in, you know, there are a lot of countries looking to the opportunity that these technologies provide.
Even though it is such a leader on renewable energy, China also still does burn a lot of coal, which might seem like a contradiction if you're looking at it from an environmental standpoint. But I imagine that's not how it is seen within China. Is that right?
I think China, you know, is the largest energy user in the world. And so it has this massive demand for energy and has essentially been using energy and any source available for many decades. Coal was the option. It was the only option that China had. But renewables are also a domestic source of energy. And so we've seen China really start to expand its use of wind and solar. So this is a gradual transition, and it's one, you know, that has broader societal and economic challenges. The coal industry in China is a huge employer. It's not going to happen overnight, but we already see a lot of positive signs that wind, solar, and other cleaner sources of energy are poised to surpass coal use in the coming years.
Climate scientists say that that 7 to 10% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions that China is promising is not nearly enough to help the world address the climate crisis. The Paris Agreement says that countries are going to get to net zero greenhouse gas emissions by around 2050. So how significant is this plan? Is it going to make a difference?
I think China's newly announced climate goals are modest, but they reflect current realities. So this transition away from coal in China will take time. And also, given the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Agreement and from climate diplomacy at large, China doesn't have to put forward a high-ambition climate pledge to be viewed as a global leader on climate change. You know, I think the bar is pretty low these days. But I do think what China has put forward will put them on a path towards reducing emissions, which have been on a growth path up until now.
It has often taken the U.S. and China working together internationally to really move the needle on climate policy globally. Was there some hope among, you know, watchers like yourself that China might step up and take a more aggressive leadership position now that the U.S. administration is backing away from the whole topic?
I think there are different ways to think about climate leadership. You know, China certainly didn't pledge as strong a goal as many had hoped, but this is coming at a time where I think many countries are putting forward more modest targets than they might have, you know, for a variety of domestic and international reasons. I think China is playing an increasingly important leadership role across the developing world. It is a major provider of clean energy technologies throughout emerging and developing countries. And this has really shifted in the last few years, where China for many years was a major investor in building new coal plants around the world. And this has really stopped. They are now building cleaner sources of energy and helping developing countries with their own clean energy transition.
The catchphrase that often gets thrown around about China in climate circles is that they underpromise on climate targets and over-deliver. What will you be watching in that realm related to this target?
I think China's international pledges really build directly on domestic policy. And so, you know, you saw a lot of important signals in the announcement from President Xi yesterday that I think will be important to watch. He talked about renewable energy, electric vehicles, carbon markets. These are all important drivers of climate implementation, and they help demonstrate that China actually has the tools in place to make sure the goals they pledge are actually met.
Joanna Lewis is an expert on China's climate policy with Georgetown University. The Oxford English Dictionary announced new entries on Wednesday, including 12 words with Caribbean roots.
They tend to center on food, and I'm all for that. A few examples: cuckoo is a dish that's popular in Barbados, made with okra, butter, and cornmeal.
Bulla comes from the Spanish word bollo. Bulla is a Jamaican flat cake that might have ginger and nutmeg, coconut, and pineapple in it.
That sounds good. Also on the Caribbean food theme, the phrase bus up shut is now in the OED. It's a fried bread, and bus up shut is patois for bust up shirt. The dictionary says the bread's flaky texture resembles shreds of fabric.
It is not all words about food, though. This new entry is another good one. Cry long water. It means having a good long cry or weeping insincerely.
I love this one, too. Brought up see. That's polite manners thanks to a proper upbringing. Used in a sentence, he always says thank you because his mom gave him good brought up see.
That one is so good. There are more than 500,000 words and phrases in the Oxford English Dictionary. Those are just a few of the latest.
You're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The world has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Denmark has issued an official apology for forcing indigenous women and girls from Greenland into using long-lasting contraceptive devices. At a ceremony yesterday in Greenland's capital, Nuuk, some of the women in attendance wiped away tears as the Danish Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, spoke.
Prevention uden samtykke. Og prævention beregnet til voksne kvinder, men brugt på barnets krop, er forkert. Og det er det, vi markerer.
Frederiksen said that birth control without consent and birth control intended for adult women but used on children's bodies is wrong.
Starting in the 1960s, Danish doctors inserted IUDs into thousands of Inuit women and school-age girls, often without their or their parents' knowledge or consent. Advocates and victims of that policy have sought justice for years. Victoria Piel Sorensen is a Danish historian who has studied Denmark's IUD program in Greenland. She says to understand how policy like this took shape, it is important to look first at how Denmark annexed Greenland in the 1950s.
So the Danish narrative was that Greenland now would become a part of Denmark on so-called equal footing. This meant that Denmark obligated itself to offering new social services, education, healthcare, and infrastructure in Greenland on par with Danish structures, at least in theory.
In reality, Sorensen says, that Denmark's colonial attitude toward Greenland continued, and the cost of providing those equal social services to the territory fueled the idea behind the forced contraception policy.
You can imagine that the more people you have to service in Greenland, the more expensive it would get, or so they imagined. And so it's in this context and from this mindset, this concern, that the Danish idea of limiting the Greenlandic Inuit fertility rate emerges.
What was the stated rationale by the Danish health authorities at the time?
The rationale was that the population is rising too fast in Greenland at the time and that it needs to be stopped.
And who was targeted with these interventions and why?
So the IUD program was launched in Greenland as a state-sponsored population control program in 1965. Leading doctors from the Danish Mother's Aid Institution, which was a state-run institution, traveled to Greenland in 1965 and distributed and fitted IUDs on thousands of Inuit girls and women to limit the Inuit population.
In some cases, I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, that this was coercive or people were pressured. And in some cases, it was actually done without prior knowledge or consent of either the kids or the parents. Is that all right?
That is right. Testimonies by women today attest to the fact that often what happened was that they were led directly from their classrooms by their teachers to a room in which a doctor would wait to fit them with an IUD. I mean, this means, of course, firstly, that often parents were not consulted and consent was not given. But it also means that you're in a situation where you have a Inuit girl, a child who's standing in front of usually an adult white and most often male Danish doctor in a space where she does not know what is going on, and the power imbalance is completely skewed. So that's part of what we think about when we think about the concept of consent in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
There's also evidence from testimonies that The women, they explained that they were not told what was happening to them, and many of them did not even know what this procedure meant for them. There's testimonies that show that some women didn't even know what had happened to them and found out later in life that they had been fitted with an IUD when they started experiencing complications when they were trying to have children.
And obviously the contraceptive effects, if you have not consented to that, are incredibly serious. But even just getting an IUD inserted is painful, even for adults.
Yes.
And it is a very intimate situation that you can imagine would be very traumatizing to a kid who doesn't know what's going on.
Absolutely. IUD is a contraceptive device that is a foreign object, usually made of copper or plastic, and it's inserted into the uterus to prevent pregnancy. The one that was used by Danish authorities in Greenland was made of plastic. It was T-shaped. It was relatively large. It was recently developed model that was rolled out quickly without really testing the impacts of it on girls and women. And in fact, doctors recommended at the time, and the developers of the technology recommended, that it only be inserted into the uteri of women who had already given birth. If you have not given birth, there's a higher risk of complications and infertility and pain.
And some of the girls who had these inserted were as young as 12 years old, right?
That's right. Some were as young as 12, even though the official reports or the news reports that we've been able to find mention the cutoff age as being 15. There's testimonies that show, and the newly released report from the Danish government shows, that girls as young as 12 had IUDs inserted. Yes.
Those are news reports published around the time that this was happening, you're saying, that gave the older age.
Correct. So one of the things that my colleagues and I have been calling attention to in our research, and this is my colleague Naya Dyrendam-Kraugård and my other colleague Josefine Lee Stay, whom I've done research with about this history. We have called attention to the fact that while there might be a popular narrative in the Danish public today that the IUD program was something that happened in the dead of night, away from public view, that it was secret and obscure, you can go back and you can look at contemporaneous news publications in the 60s and in the 70s, and you can see that the IUD program in Greenland was widely discussed, frequently discussed, and also celebrated with sensational headlines that I would say made light of Inuit Greenlandic reproductive life. One headline that I have for you from 1967 exclaims, "Greenland to be spiralized," with an exclamation mark, where spiralized refers to the conventional coil shape of an IUD, although the one that was in fact used in this program was T-shaped. But in other words, this wasn't a secret endeavor.
Yeah, so the spiral is another name for the IUD, and they were using it in a very lighthearted way in that headline.
Yes.
So those reports, those headlines were in media in Denmark, not in Greenland. So the result was that people in Denmark knew about and celebrated this forced contraception, while in Greenland, the women and girls experiencing it didn't understand what was being done to them.
That is a correct characterization, although I should say that the IUD program was also reported about in Greenlandic newspapers. Now, that, of course, right, we cannot conclude that this means that the girls and the women that it happened to even knew what it was about when it actually was, when they were subjected to this practice.
I'm curious what the doctors who were part of this program thought of it. Do we know how they explained their participation, or what, you know, potential benefit they might have seen from this program?
I've looked at as many reports as I have been able to find, and I think that they had an idea that they were doing the right thing and that they were doing something progressive and needed. The Danish doctor who led the IUD project in Greenland was actually working in collaboration with an American organization called the Population Council, which was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. And they were very concerned with what they called global overpopulation. And in that realm of things, in that organization, and for population, overpopulation advocates, Greenland and the work that the Danish doctors did in Greenland with the IUD became a celebrated success story of how you might handle so-called overpopulation.
We are hearing from Victoria Peel Sorensen, a Danish historian who studied the forced contraception program that Denmark ran in Greenland for many years. Yesterday, the Danish prime minister formally apologized to women and girls who were victims of that policy. I asked Sorensen about the lifelong repercussions those women faced.
That's an extremely important issue. And I can't speak for the women than girls who were subjected to IUD abuse. And I cannot and I won't speak for the Greenlandic Inuit community. But when you listen to the women who have spoken out, you will hear them recount experiencing pain, infertility, shame, confusion, and lifelong trauma as a result of their coerced inclusion in the IUD program. And then if we look simply, if we think about it in a sort of even larger picture, and we look simply at the population statistics, we can see that from 1965 to 1973, so in less than 8 years, the birth rate in Greenland was cut down more than half.
Wow. And that was around the time period that this program was at its largest, right? The insertion of these IUDs?
That's right. So the largest or the most intense period of the program you might date to between 1965 and 1970. During that time, my colleagues and I, we have estimated that 3,821 women of the ages between 14 and 39, or what amounts to 56% of Greenlandic Inuit women in this age range, they had gotten an IUD.
Wow.
In less than 5 years, about half of the women and girls in this age range had gotten an IUD.
And so there were population-wide impacts of that.
There were. And like I said, we can see that the children born fell 50%. And we can only speculate about the detrimental effects that such an extreme mechanism of population control has had for national economic self-sufficiency in Greenland, for example, and also for the fight for independence in Greenland. Because as Naya Dyrendam Graugaard and Josefine Lee Stae and I argue, what you're potentially looking at here is you're looking at the loss of a generation of indigenous Greenlandic Inuit children.
Today, for context, the population of Greenland is only about 56,000 people. So that number of almost 4,000 IUDs back in the 60s and 70s is a large chunk of that, or a significant chunk of that.
It's very significant.
This policy didn't entirely end until the 1990s, right?
That's right. So while you might technically date the program itself, as we talk about it and how it was launched in 35, you might technically date it to have ended formally in 75. There were unethical, manipulative, and coercive practices of IUD insertion that continued well into the late 20th century in Denmark. So there are women who have come forward and who have recounted stories of being involuntarily fitted with an IUD up into the 90s. Mm. And I would say, just to add to that, there's the Danish administration of the healthcare system in Greenland ends in 92. And then in 92, it is the Greenlandic government that takes over the administration of the healthcare system. So these women are recounting that this practice has continued and bled into the Greenlandic Home Rules administration of the healthcare system.
So I understand there is currently a lawsuit being brought by women who had these IUDs inserted. What are they asking for?
They are asking the Danish government to recognize that their human rights have been breached as a result of this IUD practice, and they are asking for reparations. My understanding is that the amount that they are currently seeking is 43 million Danish kroner in reparations.
That's about $6.5 million they're asking for. Did the Danish prime minister offer anything beyond words in her apology? Was there any talk of a financial compensation?
Yes. So after years of pressure by the women and their allies, the Danish prime minister, Mette Frederiksen, finally announced that Denmark will pay some form of reparations, although it remains to be seen how much. And there are Greenlandic Inuit people and politicians who are currently asking for the reparative work that this apology will require. They're asking for monetary compensation, for access to psychologists and counseling, and so on. So in other words, it's not generally seen as enough to apologize, but this apology is the beginning of a long process of necessary reparative work. And it's uncertain how Mette Frederiksen and the Danish government will decide to take on and carry out this responsibility.
I know that you yourself are Danish, but I wonder how you've seen this being discussed by the women who were impacted by this policy.
I have seen that it is significant. But it has come several years after the women came forward with their stories. Since the IUD program began in the 60s, these women have already been waiting a long time. And with the years that have passed since this history entered the Danish media landscape, they've been made to wait even longer. Now, this doesn't mean that the apology is not seen as significant. It is. And in fact, as the four women of the group of women who have been impacted, Naya Lübert, proclaimed in the Greenlandic Inuit news media, KNR, this week, she said, and I quote, that their fight and resistance has borne fruit. So it is significant. Now what remains to be seen is what will materialize of it in terms of actual material support and reparations.
Victoria Peel Sorensen is a Danish historian who's extensively researched Denmark's forced contraception policies in Greenland. Yesterday, Denmark made a formal apology for the decades-long practice. Sorensen is now a professor at the University of Colorado, Boulder. This is part of our ongoing coverage of Greenland, including recent reporting on the independence movement there. You can find that coverage at theworld.org. Next week, we will have a look at how climate change is affecting people there and how what happens in Greenland could have impacts across the globe.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. In northern Ghana, climate change is a hot and dry reality, a reality that's taken a toll on a region heavily dependent on agriculture. As food production has plummeted, tens of thousands of people have had to move. One particular crop, though, could help change the picture.
It's called Fonio, and Chef Fatmata Binta has been championing it for years. She spoke with us for The Big Fix, our reporting project, about people around the globe meeting the challenges of climate change. Chef Binta joined us from Accra, the Ghanaian capital, and started with the basics about Fonio.
Imagine couscous, imagine quinoa, but it's more closer to couscous. It's very fluffy, also very nutty. It has that nutty taste. It is indigenous to West Africa. It is gluten-free. It has a very short lifespan. So when you sow, you harvest within 8 to 12 weeks. And it's a grain also that is very easy to cook. We've been able to create other recipes from Fonio. So we've been able to do breads, cakes, different things. It's a very versatile ingredient.
So help us understand how these ancient grains like Fonio are actually playing a role in the fight against climate change.
Fonio is easy to grow, and you don't need much water. And drought is a big problem now across Africa, not just West. And Fonio is a drought-resistant grain. whenever it's planted, you don't need water. As long as it has rained, it can sustain itself. And it has short life cycle. And you don't have need to plow the land too much. So if you think about a very sustainable grain, you know, that reduces the footprint of too much water, you know, too much plowing, destroying the land, it regenerates itself. It's a very sustainable grain to grow more right now and less of what is destroying our land.
How widely is it grown currently, like in northern Ghana?
Not much, because it's also considered an underutilized crop, abandoned. Even though it's ancient, it's been around for so long, but most people are still catching up with it. It's picking up now because for the last 2 years, my organization, which is a non-profit called Fulani Kitchen Foundation, and we trained women in the north of Ghana to bring it back, you know, to their menu, to their farms. It can be something that we can also export to support them economically.
The United Nations has termed Fonio one of the 100 forgotten foods of Africa. What does that mean, the forgotten food?
It means, for me, the way I see it, it means people need to diversify more. Before we started this project, we did this case study where we went to all the local markets, and it was shocking that we couldn't find Fonio in the local markets. But then you can find rice from Thailand easily. So that it also ties to the mindset, you know. But that is changing now. You know, the health and wellness trend also is growing. People are waking up to all this.
So the thing about Fonio is that it's a pretty labor-intensive crop. It takes a lot of work to process once it's been harvested. And even then, I understand it's got fairly low yield. So, I mean, to put it bluntly, can investing in Fonio cultivation actually meet the needs of people in the region amid this intense climate change trend?
Absolutely. Mechanization needs to happen. If there is enough mechanization to dehusk, to thresh, and I think if that burden is eased, more farmers would grow foods, not just Fonio. They'll grow all types of food. And that can also translate to more access to these ingredients in local markets, and also them going from small-scale farmers to larger scale. But mechanization needs to happen for it to take off completely.
Talk a bit more about your work with women. I mean, do you see women in northern Ghana as kind of like the vector by which Fonio will catch on?
Absolutely. They are the gatekeepers. Definitely. Because, you know, it's also considered a female crop. And the reason why most times, traditionally, the men will take the land that is considered fertile to grow other crops. And then they will hand the arid areas to the women. So that's how the women started growing Fonio. And it became a female crop. Also, as an organization, we are launching a new initiative called the Fonio Heritage Village, because we want to build a center that can process Fonio and package and sell, distributing local stores. And the reason why we want to build a center is because most of these women, as much as we train them with the best practices and placing value for better production, better nutrition, better environment, and better lives, but they hold the indigenous knowledge. They hold the agricultural best practices that, you know, modern science cannot understand. So we are trying to create a space that can bring all this knowledge together in a space to collaborate so that innovation can happen.
How did you become so interested in Fonio in the first place, Chef Binta?
That's a very good question. I am passionate about Fonio. And the reason why, I come from a very large family in Sierra Leone. And I experienced civil war when I was almost a teenager.
So, and the because civil I come war from in a Sierra Leone. Yeah, back
yes,
in the 90s.
Yes, civil war in Sierra Leone. Mm. And because I come from a very large family, we had to move to a small village in Guinea. And we moved into a village that could probably accommodate about 200 people. And we were over 1,000 people in that small village. And the food that was already available in the village couldn't sustain us. You know, things like rice, potatoes, and all this. It couldn't. So my family had to fall back on Fonio. And that's how we sustained ourselves within that 2 years, eating Fonio in different ways. So once I became a chef, and knowing that how much Fonio helped me survive those hard years, I feel like it's a responsibility to not let something that saved me and my family to be lost. You know what I mean? I can't sit back when I have a platform. I have a voice, you know. I also have a restaurant that can champion grains because I see the restaurant as a vehicle to educate people. For me, it's very important to not sit back and watch Onyo get lost.
Chef Binta, what do you hope to see moving forward? Can you just paint the picture of a thriving agricultural sector for us where Fonio is playing a vital role?
I hope to see Fonio in a lot of restaurants. I hope to see it in markets, most importantly. I don't want to see it just on shelves. I want to see it in local markets, widely accessible. And I want everyone to know about Fonio because sometimes I still find it shocking that as much as it's an ancient grain, I still have to explain what Fonio is to people right. Who are local. So I want to see that happen. And I want to see the world eat more Fonio, the way we are eating rice. That's how I want to see it.
Fatmata Binta is a chef in Accra, Ghana. She was telling us about the grain, Fonio.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you very much for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust, Cindy Ingalls, Dodie and Billy Crockett, and Catherine Harris and Tom Kaiser. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.